The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Connect with ultra-fast speeds and our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
9:29 this Thursday morning. Stephen Fry, good morning.
Good morning to you, Ryan. Hello.
It's nice to talk to you again. And here we are back in the classics, the world of the classics. I think it's a world, I could see you in a toga with laurel leaves around your head. Not imperious, but certainly a part and parcel of a knitting group maybe with Cicero.
Well, a lot of classicists, of course, would say, you know, you have to make a choice with classics. Are you a Latinist or are you a Hellenist? Does your heart belong to Greece or to Rome? And you've obviously painted me in a Roman toga and Roman laurels, you see.
Yeah, I shouldn't have done that, of course. But go on.
But I have to say, my heart is always. I remember as a boy when I used to love knowing the Roman names for the Greek gods, but I always used the Greek names. I always thought she was Athena, not Minerva, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, all the gods have different names except Apollo, who's the same in both.
And that's it, isn't it? Childhood lends itself to these stories initially, and then they're so strong and they're so exciting that they just travel with you to the grave, essentially.
You're so right. Absolutely. They certainly have with me. There's something about them that just sticks in the mind, and the characters and the personalities in them grow as you grow. So, you know, you think of them in a certain way when you're young with a certain kind of dash and excitement, and then they become enriched and more fascinating the older you get. So a character like Achilles, who's a golden, glorious character when you're young, there's, you know, the tragedy of him and the impulsive stupidity of him, the rashness, the temper, all those qualities, you realize are so much a part of who he is and so much a part of who we are. I mean, the great thing about these myths is that they understand what it is to be human, I think, so completely.
Yeah, I mean, even you say Achilles, and we'll say, all right, Achilles' heel. And you say, well, actually, it comes from there was a warrior once upon a time. Or you talk about going on an odyssey, and that comes from our friend Odysseus. I mean, the language, you're a language guy. I just think the language, whether it's from our friends in Greece or Rome, has traveled again so profoundly that it's almost like a detective game when you're reading books sometimes to try and find the etymology or whatever.
Absolutely right. You can look back, and so much of our language and our discourse and the way we think about things does originate from Greece and Rome, and is there in the language, as you rightly say. I mean, even in the story of Troy and its aftermath, there's a character called there's a mentor, for example. That's where we get the word mentor. There's a stentor, for that matter, who's got a very loud voice, and stentorian voices, you know. I mean, there's so many of these, you think, oh, that's where that's from. Good heavens. And also, I love the fact that because the Trojan War is a kind of later part of Greek myth, when it's no longer semi-divine heroes, you know, who have gods for fathers. They're pretty human. All the participants are human beings, but the gods do still get involved in it. And you can make up your mind as to how much the gods really do. I'm sure you, like me, sometimes might say, oh, the muse wasn't with me that day. We don't really believe there's a muse sitting on one's shoulder talking into one's ear. And similarly, the Greeks, if they were, you know, in a battle and one of them drew back a bow and pulled off a really good shot, they would say, thank you, Apollo, because Apollo was the god of archery, you know. So it's hard to say when the gods involve themselves in human affairs, whether it's a metaphor, whether really you're just using the god in the same way as Basil Fawlty shaking his fist at the roof saying, thank you, God. whether they are genuinely involved. That's what I love about it. It's that mixture of the fantastic and the real.
As you were asking me, I was laughing because I often say, well, the chat show gods were smiling on me last Friday night when something good happened. You know, I just think, and then my colleagues will say, no, we worked hard to make that happen. I said, no, I know that, but there was an element of the Olympian involvement, you know.
It's impossible to avoid thinking like that somehow. I rather like it. I think it's a good thing, even if one doesn't, as you say, actually believe that there are chat show gods. And if there are, I wonder who, well, I guess in your case, Terry Wogan would have ascended to it, you know, in the Irish chat show gods and the wonderful Gay Byrne,
of course. Of course. They're up there definitely on whatever Olympian mountain for the former hosts go to. Good crack, though, I'd say. Let me ask you about the physicality of visiting a country like our city, whether it's Athens or Rome or wherever it might be. And it's kind of all history. If you love history as much as I suspect you do, and I would, and most of our listeners would, when you go to a place, whether it's famine Ireland or whether it's Tudor Britain, England, or whether it's ancient Greece, do you ever kind of wish you could just close your eyes and be there for 3 minutes?
Yeah, and indeed, you kind of do. I mean, it's impossible. For example, in Greece, Delphi is a wonderful place to visit because there's so much there. That was the location of the famous oracle where Greeks throughout myth and indeed through real historical Greece would go to Delphi, and there would be a priestess called a pitha who would interpret the words of Apollo, and they were always slightly ambiguous, you know, so you never quite knew what the future held. And there was a kind of gas, that a sort of sulfurous gas that came up and is, you know, part of the geology of that area, which of course they thought was Gaia, the earth goddess, sending up messages. But if you go there now, you can feel and see and touch these stones and these, you know, it's a ruin, but it's a very well-preserved ruin. And there's even above one area you can walk up, there's a running track, as what the Greeks called a stadion, from which we get stadium. Of course, stadium was a length, and you almost don't even have to close your eyes. You just half close them, and you think you can hear the cheer of Greeks, and you can see a queue of Greek people worriedly lining up, waiting for the oracle to pronounce on their destiny. Mm. It's fantastic to be that in touch. Another place is Epidaurus, or as the Greek pronounce it now, Epidavros, which is the famous theater. But there's also an Asclepion. There was a Greek healer called Asclepius, who actually became divine and became the god of medicine. And these Asclepions were basically exactly like hotel spas today. There would be baths, there would be white-coated or white-shifted priests and people who would massage you, interpret your dreams, clean your guts out with various purgatives and so on. Mm. And actually you can go to it and you can see this graffiti and you can see, little bits that the healers, you know, the staff had carved in for people's treatments. I mean, it's just incredibly close, you know, that's what's so wonderful.
That's it.
How close our ancestors are.
Yeah, Cave et Emptor, Cave Canum, you know, these.
Yes,
I'm going Roman again because I'm leaning there. Yeah. We're covering the whole panoply here of the ancients. So that's, but back to Troy. I presume you see in Troy and in most history, particularly the epic stories, you see a salutary, I don't know if warning is the right word, but certainly a salutary tale.
Yes, I think what's wonderful about it is that although it's the Trojan War and it's the siege of a city, well, every element of it is so profoundly human and is to do with our weaknesses and faults, our vanities, our rage, our love, betrayal, all those things are what animates the story and makes it last as long as it has lasted. And, you know, to be reintroduced to it as I was a year or so ago when I started re-researching and going into it, I was just staggered by how close to our life it is. I mean, there's a horrible fact is that the Iliad, which is Homer's famous epic poem, which is about a short period towards the end of the Trojan War, the incredibly important period, and it starts with a plague. It starts with a disease sweeping through the Greek camp and the horror that it brings. And amazingly, the way Homer describes it, it starts with the animals.
Right. Oh my
and
gosh!
It goes from the animals to the humans.
Yeah.
Zoonotic, as we call it grandly these days, and all that talk about bats and pangolins and things in China. As soon as I saw that that news, I was reminded of the Trojan War, of how. And was it an insight that Homer had, or Homer's people, that when you had a plague, it often started with the animals? I mean, the way he describes it, Apollo storms down from Olympus with and fires plague arrows into the Greek camp, and they hit the animals first, and the animals become sick, and then the humans get it. But it gave me real pause when I saw that. I thought, heavens.
And also, I often find the story of Cassandra fascinating, whether it's about the economy and somebody going, you're all spending too much, that there's going to be a property bubble, or equally with this thing going, we're going to have to lock down, and they're not believed until
poor Cassandra.
It's too late, and then everyone goes, Cassandra told us. Like, well, no, listen to the poor woman.
Yes, that's right. She was cursed by Apollo, as you rightly say, to be a he'd given her the gift of prophecy. Because she was a priestess in his table. She was a royal princess of Troy, in fact. She was
right,
a daughter of Hecuba and Priam, and so a sister of Hector and Paris and the others. And she was worked in the temple, as it were, of Apollo, and he gave her the gift of prophecy. He then moved in to take his reward, as it were.
Yes.
And she said, no, absolutely not. I'm not going to. I refuse.
This wasn't transactional.
And he was so furious. He couldn't take away the gift of prophecy, because gods can't take away gifts they give you. But he could amend it. So he spat into her open mouth as she was saying the word no. And that spit was the curse that, although she had this perfect gift of prophecy, no one would ever believe it.
Gosh.
And of course, it is true, isn't it, that when you prophesy, if you are correct, people retrospectively don't believe you. So, for example, if, let us suppose, the lockdown had worked perfectly, and those who predicted that the disease would go really, really badly, unless there was a lockdown, you have the lockdown, then everything is solved. People would say, see, there was no problem. There was no need for that lockdown.
Yeah.
You say, well, no, because you predict something, you can alter the course of the future, if you see what I mean.
Yes, of course.
But of course, that hasn't been the case with us, has it? And let's not go down that.
Well, it is. You know, I was just talking a little bit earlier on before we had our conversation about what you might call lockdown loneliness. It's a pandemic in itself.
It is. I think it's very important, Ryan, though, to remember that obviously that everyone is different and people respond in different ways. And a lot of people are pressured into thinking that they should respond to this lockdown in a certain way, that, you know, they should learn Russian and bake soda bread every day and all that sort of thing. And if they don't, they feel inadequate. And they see so many examples of people who, you know, knitted a carpet and so on. And they feel like, oh, I've failed. But there is no right way to deal with it.
Yeah.
And similarly, not everybody dislikes being excluded from the social world. Some people who are anxious at parties and in the public sphere, and maybe have a touch of agoraphobia and a fear of going outside. That for them, that's a kind of, they're almost embarrassed to admit that if it came to a choice between enforced socialization and enforced seclusion, they would choose enforced seclusion any day.
Yeah, for sure.
And there are plenty of us who feel a bit like that.
Well,
and then we feel a bit like we miss it. You know, the point is, there's such a range of responses that we can all have that for anyone to say, this is how we all feel, I think is, it's a bit like when people say we're all in the same boat, I want to shout. No, we're not. We may all be on the same sea, the same rough seas, but we've all got very different boats. Some of us are lucky enough to have fully weatherproof, beautiful. Others are in super yachts and, you know, cruisers. And some people are in very leaky vessels indeed. And they don't like hearing that everyone's in the same boat, because that's obviously not true. But also, everyone's got their own way of coping or not coping and their own fear and anxiety. But you're certainly right that there's a great deal of pressure on our minds and our stability and our inner strength. And it's very easy to lose it. But I think the most important thing is to remember that it's however one feels is okay. There is no right way to respond to this. There is no approved way that healthy people respond to it, as opposed to a bad way that unhealthy people, because we're all in this kind of learning position. We don't know how we're going to feel in a week's time, let alone how we feel now. We don't know whether we'll make it to Christmas without breaking down, or we don't know, you know, or we might actually think, oh, thank goodness, I love this. I love just being alone at home or with just with, well, one or two people of my family or whatever, and don't let it stop, you know, and then they'll feel guilty for feeling that.
There's also the need to I suppose, take away a sense of shame if you're feeling emotionally, mentally fragile.
Oh, absolutely. That's the last thing to feel ashamed about. I mean, I think, you know, for most of us are going to have periods of that, periods of real fragility and instability and wobble. And I, you know, it's so important that we all support each other in that regard. And if you haven't already, you know, why not write an email or a message or a, you know, WhatsApp or whatever it is you do to your family group and say, just to remind us that if any of us suddenly feel a bit, you know, down and really worried and so on, we're there for each other, you know. That's so important.
My 21-year-old oldest daughter said to me one day, "You're just not feeling it today, are you?" I thought, what a great expression.
That's good.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah. Just not feeling it today, are you? Because she kind of saw it in my head, or I was frowning or something like that, and I just thought, that's insightful.
Yeah, that's a good phrase. It's a lot better than that, the one that's driving me crazy at the moment, which is, "You got this." Don't tell me. What have I got?
Stephen, it's driving me mad. Like things like, they reached out to my people. You know, they
reached out,
or to your point, or we're going to drill down on this now, or we're going to unpack that.
Drill down to the granular detail.
That's it. Are we going to unpack this argument piece by piece? You're going, well, what happened to language? It was fine. It wasn't broken. Stop fixing it.
It's weird, isn't it?
Isn't
I know what gets so. I mean, I try not to be a language snob.
Yes.
I mean, I don't mind people using language in unusual ways, or, you know, splitting infinitives or whatever. But it's just the endless batting and forward of cliches. And people describe me as, "Oh, you're dropping your new book, are you?"
That's because they're dropping a new series on Netflix, and then you get pushback. You're getting pushback.
I think it's important to laugh at it.
Listen, laugh at it, and then when they come in to feast on your innards, to ignore them, because we're just trying to have a laugh.
I said to a friend who works in radio like you, I said, "See if you can say to your interviewees that you will cut them short and not mention their book or their film or whatever it is if they start a sentence with the word 'so.'"
Oh, very good. Well, that's an interview over. We wouldn't have a radio show.
You really wouldn't, would you?
No, not at all. We'd all be taken off. So, Stephen, it's been great to have you on the. But you said a beautiful thing once about mood, which I loved, which was that mood is the equivalent of the weather.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes, I think that's right. I think a lot of people, when their mood is really, really down, or indeed really, really up, they either blame themselves or they try and deny it. And in fact, it is like the weather. The weather is real. When it's raining, it really is raining. You can't pretend it isn't.
Yes.
You can't think the water away. But nor is it your fault. You haven't caused that rain. It's something that that just, you know, will happen from time to time. And the fact that it's raining doesn't mean that it might not be sunny tomorrow. So it's those three things that are so important to remember, that mood, you know, a down mood is not your fault. It's something that happens from, you know, outside your will or your moral center. It's not something to be blamed for. It's like the weather in that sense. Also, it is real. It's no good denying it and saying, "Oh, I'm imagining it." Because if it's real, it's real. And just, you know, understand and live with it. But also don't feel, "Oh, that's it then. Now I'm down. That's forever." Because the clouds will roll away. And so some form of, you know, mental umbrella if you can. But the most important thing is not to blame yourself or feel that it's permanent, I guess. Yeah. So that's certainly the way I try and convince myself.
Because you said at one point, I don't like my own company very much, which is odd given how many times people very kindly tell me that they put me on their ideal dinner party guest list. So it's ghastly. If you take that to its natural conclusion, if you were invited to that ideal dinner party, you'd hate to sit beside yourself.
It is a bit mad, isn't it? But I think, you know, we're all like that a bit, aren't we? It's quite good when you realise sometimes, what is it I'm feeling now? Oh, I know what it is. I'm annoying myself.
Yes.
We know when friends and even loved ones can annoy one. It's bound to be true that there will be times when you get needled and bit and you know peed off by your friends. But you can also get a bit annoyed by your own company and think, oh, shut up, Stephen, stop talking to yourself like that. Just, you know, I want to ignore myself for a while.
I know. How do you do that?
It's not easy. No. It has to be said.
But I think that even part of it is escape. And escape, I've found in the last number of months, is in, weirdly, crime fiction.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'm just about to start. I've got it's sort of next down on my pile, John Banville's Snow.
Now, Stephen, I've been banging on about it for the last 2 weeks. I can't believe you picked that one. Yeah, it's delicious and dark.
Because I like his crime writing. He writes...
Oh, great. Benjamin Black.
Exactly, as Benjamin Black. But this, he's combining his kind of literary chops, and few writers alive in English have greater literary chops than John Banville. I've loved his previous books. And with his fabulous ability to tell a great crime story. So I just can't wait to read it.
I'd be shocked if you'd be disappointed now. And I hope I'm not doing a Cassandra on it, but I think you'll be okay.
Yeah. Also, there's a new... there's a new Jack Reacher, and I have to say I'm a sucker for Jack Reacher.
We need stuff like that, though.
People are very shocked when I say that, because he's kind of like so manly and military and kind of, you know, he's like he's carved out of rock in some ways. But he comes out of the same stable as Clint Eastwood's Man With No Name or John Wayne characters or Gary Cooper characters. There's something... it is so different from me. You know, I'm a fluffy, silly, sentimental old fool. And even in the way I use language, I'm ornate and so on. Whereas Lee Child uses language like Hemingway, stripped down, very few descriptive words. And I think that's probably why I like it, in the same way that opposites attract. So.
Can I ask you, I have to go now, but can I ask you, can we do this a chat maybe between now and Christmas and talk books or something like that for
Wouldn't
the crack?
That be fun?
I'd love to do that, because we're singing the same song then, and maybe you'll give us a song or two that you like. We'll play a track for you coming up to Christmas, and if you're free to do it, now you don't have to say
that's
yes now on air. That'll catch you on the hoof, but it'll be great. I'd love that.
I was due to be in Dublin herself, so I was, were it not for this nonsense. So this will make up for it.
I'd love that. Listen, congratulations on Troy. It completes a beautiful trilogy that would make a very comfortable addition to any bookshelf in people's houses around the country. And let's do this again sometime soon, Stephen. Massive response to you on the text, by the way. You are beloved, so please take that in your sails as you head wherever you're going next. Thank you, Stephen Fry.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Nice to talk to you. Good night indeed. Must have had to put in a late night. But loads of text. 51551. I could listen to Stephen all day, says Molly. I love the way he describes the way we're dealing with the lockdown. And my boat is very rocky at the moment. Well, sail safely, Molly. And as Stephen says, we're all on that sea. Please tell up, Stephen, that the fabulous Jeeves and Wooster has been one of our COVID escapes. I recommend it all, of course. And Marion O'Dwyer says, "Will you ask Stephen, is he bringing out a book of his ties? He did it, the Fry Ties, which was him posting pictures on Instagram throughout the lockdown. So we'll talk about that. I might try and get him on again, because I mean, he's just eminently enjoyable to speak to. I can tell you that, and hopefully to listen to. 8 minutes to 10. We're going to talk to a youngster who might or might not know stuff. We'll do that shortly.